Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Please be seated. Just a moment.
Never mind.
Shirley to the rescue. Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus William Robert Osgood II. The appellant, Mr. Osgood, is represented by Gregory Erlandson, an attorney from Rapid City, and the State of South Dakota is represented by Assistant Attorney General Grant Gormley from Pier. Mr. Erlandson, you may proceed, sir.
Good morning, members of the court. Counsel, may it please the court. Here before the court this morning, submitting that the trial court abused its discretion in failing to allow a defense expert to interview the alleged child victim in this matter. These are very, very difficult cases. They're difficult for everyone. Nobody looks lightly for a reason to overturn a conviction based upon such a heinous crime. In light of the nature of these types of crimes, special rules have been developed by the courts and legislatures to recognize the inherent difficulty that children have in these cases, the inherent difficulty with evidence and the production of evidence. Specifically, South Dakota has the tender years exception. It has also opined, this court has opined that experts may testify on the characteristics of sexual abuse that is consistent with children who have been sexually abused. It also has allowed experts to testify based upon their observations of a child, an alleged child victim, and compare their observations of that child to the characteristics inherent in children they believe have typically been sexually abused. The court has previously addressed a request for independent examinations, whether they're physical or psychological, in a different context, and the state agrees with me that this specific issue before the court is one of first impression. In previous cases, the court has said that when determining whether or not a trial court has abused its discretion in denying or granting a request for an independent physical or psychological exam, the court has said that there must be a substantial need or reason for the exam. Now, the proffered reasons in the prior cases, specifically McCafferty and State v. Carlson, was to determine whether or not the child suffered from any mental or moral delusions which tended to distort either the imagination or credibility of the victim. In this case, the proffered purpose was specifically advanced to rebut the state's evidence on whether or not this specific child exhibited characteristics consistent with those of someone who had been sexually abused. The state's evidence rested for that prospect. The expert testimony came specifically from a one-hour interview conducted by an interview by the state's expert. The process in this case, as it is in Pennington County and Meade counties, when it comes to forensic interviews, is law enforcement or Department of Social Services will refer a child to the Child Advocacy Center, specifically Laura Hawkins, who will conduct a forensic interview. She testified that the sole foundations for her opinion come from her, in this case, one-hour interview of the child. I submit that allowing the state an opportunity to interview a child and formulate subjective opinions based upon her perception of the characteristics that are exhibited by the child in a particular case, and on the other hand, not allowing the defense expert to do the same, is a denial of his right to a fair trial and a denial of access to evidence.
It's not the same thing, as a DNA test where you have a scientific basis for wanting another opinion. This isn't really science here. This is something maybe quasi-science, isn't it?
That's correct, and a very good point, Justice Konenkamp. Here, we're talking not about objective criteria or data. We're talking about one professional's opinion, subjective opinion, on whether or not a child exhibits characteristics that she believes or he believes may be consistent or not with sexual abuse. It's the one opportunity, and the cases that we've cited before the court indicate that that is one critical difference. It's not an objective, empirical data that they're looking at. There are a myriad of factors. There's no checklist that an expert looks down and says, this child exhibited this characteristic, and this characteristic, and so therefore they've been abused. It's subjective.
I guess I'd like to hone in a little bit on your argument. Are you saying that you have an automatic right to interview the reported victim anytime the state does, or that in this instance alone the court abused its discretion?
Well, I believe there's a substantial need and reason for an independent psychological evaluation in cases similar to this. In this case, the state brought forth expert testimony based upon those specific characteristics.
Maybe what I'm asking you is, you're well aware our decisions have precedential value.
Correct.
Are you telling this court that it's an automatic anytime the state gets access to the victim, the defendant should, or that the defendant still has to make some kind of a showing to get the court to exercise its discretion in your favor? How are we going to handle these cases in the future?
I believe this court, and I've recommended to this court, that it adopt certain factors in determining whether or not the burden, in this case, I believe that the burden in Cafferty, that there should be a substantial need and justification or reason for such an exam. I believe that that's appropriate and adequate, that we should have some sort of a burden in order to justify the intrusion, in order to balance the alleged victim's privacy rights as opposed to the defendant's right to a fair trial. And in considering the special circumstances and the unique evidentiary rules that are afforded to child victims in these types of cases, I believe it is all the more important that we ensure that the defendant receives a right to a fair trial and that the verdict or ultimate conviction is reliable. In this case, allowing the state's experts to be the only person to interview the child and come up with and select what criteria or what characteristics she believes are important in comparing whether or not the child has exhibited characteristics consistent with sexual abuse is, I believe, a denial of due process for my client.
Now, your expert did get to see the videotape of the interview.
That's correct.
And I assume your expert also sat in during the child's testimony in the trial?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So then you and your expert had an opportunity then to consult about what types of questions should be asked of the child on cross-examination in the trial? Is that true, too?
Yes, sir.
What would we know now that we don't know if your expert had interviewed the child?
The short answer to that, Justice Konenkamp, is we don't know. My expert testified, or our expert testified, that there are a myriad of different characteristics, and that all of these characteristics are shaped and based upon the family dynamics, the entirety of the child's history.
But if we don't know, if you say the answer is we don't know, then how have you shown that there's prejudice in not having the interview?
Right, and that was addressed also, I believe that was State versus Gray, Your Honor, or Gray versus State, the Florida court said, we don't look at what could have been gathered. We look at whether or not a denial of evidence has occurred. The court said that psychological interviews are very important in child sex cases, and that in the absence of a personal interview, or that an adequate foundation cannot be established in these complex cases, unless there is a personal interview. In this case, they granted the right for the defense expert to interview, and an adequate review of the child's entire history and background. In this case, it's important to recognize Laura Hawkins testified, the state's expert, that she didn't know anything about the child's background. When she receives the referral, all she asks for is what happened, basically, whether or not there are physical injuries that we need to be concerned about. But she doesn't want to know anything about the child's background, whether there are other potential causes for the for the characteristics that the child might be exhibiting. But the courts have made, some of the courts that we've cited have made clear that it is not an adequate substitution to say that a defense expert has an opportunity to simply review the interview conducted and generated by the state's expert and the materials or observing the victim at trial.
Following up on Justice Kornkamp's question, though, aren't you asking us to presume that there is prejudice? Because we've always required a showing of prejudice in our criminal cases through in the past, but you're saying, well, you have to presume it because we don't have the ability to show it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I believe we can presume that there's prejudice here, Your Honor, because if you look at it, what the evidence was in this case, the evidence, apart from the child's testimony, was that she exhibited characteristics consistent with sexual abuse, that she did not indicate any behaviors or characteristics that indicated she was being coached. The entirety of Laura Hawkins' testimony was based upon her interview, the interview in which she worked with law enforcement. And that's another point I'd like to make, if I may. All of the cases and the proffered purposes in the authority that's cited in the briefs and the relationship between the prosecution and the state's expert are different than they are in this case. In this case, Laura Hawkins is not the treating therapist. She's not a treating counselor. She is the one person, and she testified to this, who is charged with the task of validating or invalidating a child's outcry and determining whether or not charges should follow. Her relationship with law enforcement she's almost a quasi-law enforcement agent. She works closely with law enforcement. In fact, in this case here, there's a 6-minute gap in the tape in which she went out to the investigator in the case and spoke with him and asked him if there were any questions she needed to follow up with, any other areas she needed to approach. None of the other cases talk about that, about having somebody so closely related with law enforcement who is the sole person charged with formulating the right questions to ask and honing in on what she feels may be important in determining or arriving at her subjective beliefs as to whether or not abuse had occurred.
But also here, we don't just have the opinion of an expert. We have the child testifying and the jury making the final determination about whether the child was telling the truth, don't we?
Yes, sir. And that's important trying to articulate the reason why I'm here and the reasons for our appeal. We're not challenging the sufficiency of the evidence. That's not what this case is about. There is, and I will concede, there is sufficient evidence to convict my client at trial. The problem is, our argument is, we're challenging his right to have a fair trial, his right to have access to evidence that the state had, and the state had its finger in formulating, if you will, and the defendant's ability to try and rebut that evidence. It comes down to, I believe, Your Honors, whether or not a defendant should be allowed to have one interview with a child where the state has an opportunity to present its subjective beliefs on the characteristics and behavior of a child, and the defense expert doesn't have a chance to rebut that.
Now, the child's therapist indicated that a further interview could re-traumatize the child. Now, is that all she said? Did she support it with reasons, or did she just give that bald-faced conclusion that it could, not would, but could, re-traumatize the child?
Your Honor, I recall that specifically, and that was Linda Holcomb was the child's treating therapist. She was treating the child for two reasons. One, because the child had been physically abused quite severely by the mother's live-in boyfriend. Also, she was being treated allegedly for some of the problems associated as a result of the alleged conduct of my client. The court, upon receiving my motion in February, I believe, of 2000, wanted to hold that motion in abeyance and said, I want to find out from the therapist, the treating therapist, whether or not this would traumatize her. The court, the state's attorney's office, did contact her and received, I believe, one paragraph or one page letter, which said that a further interview would re-traumatize her.
Would or could?
I believe it was would, Your Honor. And I conceded to the court that, of course, any interview, anytime somebody has to talk about what may have happened, would probably, to a certain degree, re-traumatize someone. There's no way you can get around that. But in this case, as I advanced to the court, we did everything possible to try and reduce the trauma. We had Dr. Mark Perrinode, who is a well-experienced and qualified psychologist who has interviewed and tried to help many, many child sex abuse victims. The state's expert agreed that our expert was eminently qualified. He testified for the defense and the prosecution. I also made it a point that I wouldn't be present at that interview. And so I think we did everything we could to try and mitigate the effects a possible another interview would have on that person.
And the judge knew that at the time he made his made the decision.
Yes, sir. In this case, the procedure is a little bit strange, or not strange, but I mean, we made our motion in February. The court waited a couple weeks until we could finally get something from the counselor, and then the court, I believe, prior to the trial, informally or formally denied our request for the hearing or for the interview, and then went on the day, kind of on the pretrial motions, in order to clean up all of the outstanding motions. I believe there were over 20 motions in limine that I had submitted, went through and finalized and on them, all the motions. So,
what is fundamentally different about this case in any other criminal case where you have a witness who wants to cooperate with one side but not the other? You know, criminal cases have numerous witnesses. Some of those witnesses cooperate with both sides and give statements. Some cooperate with only one side and give statements. And what is fundamentally different about this case that gives you some right that's not present in any other case? Now, I understand the state used its experts, but there's cases where defense will use experts that the state doesn't have access to that witness. So why is this case different?
I think it's different, Justice Center, because in most criminal cases, apart from this type of a context, you don't have an expert for the state testifying based upon its a personal subjective belief about, no matter what the law says. I know we can't vouch for credibility of children, but in this case, you've got an expert who is saying basically the same thing.
He's essentially interviewing, the expert's essentially interviewing the witness.
Correct, Your Honor.
And that's what private investigators do for defense witnesses, and the state doesn't always have access to those witnesses. So
correct.
What's the difference?
But most investigators don't have the ability to get on the stand and say, yes, this person indicated or exhibited characteristics and behaviors that are consistent with crime that the person's being charged with. I think that's a fundamental difference, Your Honor.
Would you expand this suggested approach to adult? Say that you had an adult interviewed by the state. Is there a difference here because it's a child victim versus an adult victim?
I think, Chief Justice Gilbertson, that the important factor to look at is, what is the proffered purpose for that expert testimony? If the proper purpose for an adult is the same as this here, that the adult exhibits characteristics and behaviors consistent one way or another with the crime that's charged, coming close to testifying as to the ultimate issue, and the defense doesn't have that opportunity to present that type of evidence based upon its own interview, then I think there is a good reason to extend it to adults. I think all of the factors that we've listed by both parties in determining whether or not compelling need or reason or substantial need and justification exist, all of those factors, I believe, play an important role in determining whether or not such an exam should be given. I think it's also important to note that one of the Nevada courts that we cited in our cases, I believe it was Marvell versus State, indicated that it's almost kind of strange or difficult to conceive that on one hand, some courts have held that it's per se ineffective assistance of counsel not to either interview the child victim or request an order for an independent examination. And then on the other, while you're making it difficult for, or while it may be difficult for a defendant to get that type of evidence, on the other hand, it's ineffective assistance of counsel not to try and get it. I believe that applies equally to this kind of case here, because we did not have an opportunity to get crucial evidence, and we don't know, and it puts us in an unfair position, I believe, to try and come up with a reason why or what our expert could have possibly conceived.
That's basically what you focus on, you know, what could have been found out or what might have been found out. When your expert did testify, though, did he give some positive indications that there were problems with this child's testimony? Suggestions that the child was fantasizing, that the child was projecting the offense onto the wrong offender, things like that.
Our expert, thank you. Our expert testified that it is crucial to understand everything about a child's background to determine whether or not the characteristics and behaviors that are present in the child are attributable to the specific abuse alleged. He's testified in this case that he did review some of the records of indicating that this child had been traumatized, had been abused before, and that all of those factors are certainly relevant in making the determination or the comparison between the child's behavior and that of a typically abused child. It's crucial, I believe, to understand that the state's expert didn't have any of that evidence. The state's expert didn't have an opportunity, didn't know whether or not the exhibits or the characteristics that she saw in the child were attributable to what my client allegedly did or what other people allegedly did. So I think that's a critical difference there in that respect, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Erlinson. Mr. Gormley.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I would like to begin, if I may, by talking about a few facts, which I think basically dispose of this issue. First of all, we had a pretrial motion in this case. It was not a pretrial motion asking to do a psychological or psychiatric evaluation of this witness. The pretrial motion said we want this particular doctor, Dr. Mark Perrenut. It didn't ask for anybody else. And what it said in the pretrial motion is we think from discussion with the state that the state's witness is going to testify that this child is credible. And that was the only specific mention. Then there was some mention about fairness, about both sides being able to do this. But there really is nothing in that motion that a judge hearing that or reading that would assume that we're talking about a psychological evaluation. So I think what's being asked for and at the time and what's being discussed today are two different things. But I'd like to center on another set of facts, and that is the state never did a psychological evaluation. The state never did a psychiatric evaluation. All the state did was to have a forensic interview. Now, I'm not sure I know what a forensic interview was until I look at this, and there was discussion with this witness about it, but it looks to me like a forensic interview is being a glorified cop. The police did not interview this victim. This particular individual did, this Laura Hawkins, and the purpose of this interview was to find out the facts, find out from this little girl what happened. It wasn't to do a psychological evaluation. It wasn't to talk about how she's credible or not credible. There was not testimony to that effect until on cross-examination the defense drug out of this person that she had said something in a pretrial hearing about credibility.
But was the state's expert asked on direct whether the child exhibited typical characteristics of a child who's been sexually abused?
You know, I don't recall precisely that being asked. It may have been, but I don't recall that precisely. The primary discussion was, what do you do? What's your job? It's to develop rapport. I deal with young children. I have to get them so they can speak to me. And then I talk to her about what happened and try to get from her the factual information. It was not a conversation about the mental makeup or delusions on the part of the child. This was simply a forensic interview, an interview to find out the facts of what happened to see if there was anything here. When the defense then comes in and they say, we want this Dr. Perrineaud. Dr. Perrineaud on the stand, when asked, have you ever watched forensic interviews? And he said, yes. Do you do them? Are you a forensic interviewer? He said, no. So he couldn't even do the thing he said. He said he couldn't do the thing that the state's witness did. Typically in cases, we have a fairness argument. It has to do with apples and apples. One side gets a psychiatrist, the other side gets a psychiatrist. One side gets a psychologist, the other side gets a psychologist. What makes this weird is one side gets a forensic interviewer and the other side wants to have a psychologist who doesn't do forensic interviews come in and do it. If there was any fairness in this, if it were going to be allowed, then I presume we're going to have the state go get a psychologist to come in and do a psychological examination so that the state gets to do the same thing the defense did.
But aren't we really just talking about two people who are skilled in interviewing children to extract from them the truth?
I don't believe that's so, because the state witness said, I'm here to develop rapport and to find out what happened, and I don't work for the state. I'm an independent individual, and basically did not discuss very much the credibility of the little girl. There was some discussion about coaching, but again, coaching is a matter of forensic interview. To me, it's not a matter of psychological evaluation. If the little girl is being told something by her mother, in the coaching context, that's not a psychological or psychiatric evaluation. And both sides got into discussions, both of these witnesses, talking about coaching. Well, if you read the record in the case, the little girl on the stand was asked what her mother, the defense counsel, said. What did your mother tell you today before you came in to testify? And she said, she told me to be brave and to tell the truth. I repeat, she told me to be brave and tell the truth. So the defense lawyer tried to take it further and said, well, did she tell you anything else? And she said, no. I think that takes care of coaching. And all this discussion about coaching, but that, again, to me, shows the fundamental difference between what a forensic interviewer does and what a psychologist does.
But doesn't that, in a way, if you have the forensic interviewer come in, who's working as an agent for law enforcement, and then you ask the little girl what the mother said, well, if there's some coaching by the forensic interviewer, if she gets her on a spin that prepares her to be a witness against a defendant, then it hasn't proved anything. There's no way of knowing yet to what extent she was coached, not by her mother, but by the forensic interviewer.
There is nothing in the record, I believe there is nothing in the record suggested by anybody on either party that this forensic interviewer did any coaching. In fact, the whole conversation and the testimony the forensic interviewer gave was to discuss how she goes about this so that she does not put any ideas in the head of this child. I don't think any fair reading of that record would suggest that there was any coaching by the forensic interviewer. The only suggestion that was ever made is maybe mother did it because there had been some physical attack on her previously or something, or maybe mother was mad at this guy who molested her daughter. But there really, other than just sort of vague suggestions of that, there's really nothing to suggest any coaching. In fact, the little girl, she's a rock solid witness. I can't imagine somebody at 5 or 6 years old. She answered the questions straightforwardly. I don't think you can read her testimony without believing that testimony. And she was straightforward and she said, Mom told me to be brave and tell the truth. And I think if Mom told her something else, the little girl would have said so. And so I don't think there's any suggestion of the coaching at all.
At the time that the defense brought on this request, had the state completed its forensic interview with the little girl?
I believe that's right. Yeah. Right. Yes.
And the trial court knew that?
I believe so.
What was the trial court's rationale then for denying the defense request?
The trial court's rationale had nothing to do with what I've just discussed about the difference between the two types of people, but I think it's an important point to make. The trial court's point of view was, as was mentioned by counsel, the motion was made, the trial court said, I want to talk to the little girl's counselor because I'm concerned about whether she'd be re-traumatized if somebody else interviewed her. And then they said, I'm going to hold this in abeyance until I find out. The counselor came back and said she felt there would be re-traumatization. And the trial court said, then I'm not going to grant this. And then when it came up, I think it was the day of the trial, and this business was brought up, it's in the motion hearing on page 11, this was brought up. And the trial court said, now let me remember back what we did with this thing. Didn't it come in and I talked to the counselor and the counselor said re-traumatize and therefore I decided what I decided, and the defense counsel said yes, that's what happened. Now, at that point, no objection was made. No argument was made to the court that I saw in that part of the record saying, wait a minute, Your Honor, I want you to know that we don't agree with that. We don't think she'd be re-traumatized because we've got this dandy psychologist who's used to doing this stuff and he wouldn't cause that to happen. None of that said. I think the trial court went through this and probably would have felt, based on the conversation, that everyone was in agreement, that there was a re-traumatization problem here, and the court said, well, then I'm going to again restate my position that I'm not going to allow this to happen. Now, when you get to that side of it, there are a number of other things that courts have looked at. I mean, if we get beyond this issue of what's a forensic interviewer and what's a psychologist and why does one require the other to have a shot at this, if you get to one where you're comparing apples and apples, often courts will look at this re-traumatization problem and consider that to be an important point. But they also will look and see whether the defense expert got to testify at length, which is what happened here. 25 pages of testimony by the defense expert laying out what the defense expert laid out. The defense expert admittedly studied all the reports and all the information, including a videotape. The defense expert saw a videotape of the interview done by the forensic interviewer.
Was the defense expert, did he testify in the area of characteristics of children that had been child abuse?
He did. He talked generally about it. I don't think there was a lot there about what about this particular child, but he certainly discussed that. He discussed an incident where the mother had been struck a couple of days earlier by her boyfriend or the person that this young child calls her father. He talked about whether there had been some sort of sexual incident between the victim a couple of years earlier with a niece or something who was a young child as well. So there was anything that this individual found in all the reports and so on that he looked at, these things were brought up. And so we certainly have a situation where the expert got to see everything and the expert got to testify at length. And this, oftentimes, courts have said when they refuse to allow a defense psychiatrist that things of that nature make it reasonable not to grant yet another interview. But I think another aspect of this, which is probably as important, is normally the courts look to see if there's strong evidence of lack of credibility on the part of the child. In this particular case, there is nothing, absolutely nothing to suggest any credibility problems on the part of this child. Nobody says it. When the child is cross-examined, you can look at the cross-examination of the victim. Not even touched, basically, about whether she was credible. You can look at the cross-examination of the defense expert. Doesn't touch this at all. I don't think you can look at this record and see any suggestion whatsoever that the child's testimony is not credible. You can dance around the edges, and try to find things and make suggestions or vague suggestions. Well, maybe this could happen or that could happen. But there's absolutely nothing to show that this child was not being direct in her answer. She answered the question. She answered them straightforwardly. She answered them like a child would answer them. In fact, I think probably the best thing that I saw in fairly short testimony on this child was she was asked if she knew the difference between the defendant and this father figure of hers. And she said no. And what the counsel was driving at was, do you know that the defendant did it, not your father figure? And she said no, and the defendant then went on to kind of explain it to her, and then she understood. She was kind of waiting for the defense counsel or the counsel to give her the answer to the question. Do you know the difference between these people? I don't know, one's tall and one's short, one's got blue eyes and one has green eyes. I mean, it's just like you would expect a 5 or 6 year old girl to answer questions. And she knew exactly what she was talking about. She knew exactly what happened. She knew exactly that the fingers were inside her. She knew exactly, she said that she knew that it hurt. She was just an excellent witness. And there just is no suggestion that there's any credibility problem here. So for the defense to come in and say, well, let's do another interview with this girl and somehow we're going to find some smoking gun that is going to show that she is not a credible witness, is, I would say, it looks impossible. I can't imagine what somebody could come up with in this case. It's so impossible, as a matter of fact, that I would say if the court decided that for some reason what we have here with two different types of witnesses, a forensic interview and a psychologist, and gets to the issue and thinks we're comparing apples and apples, even if you do that, I don't think you can find any prejudice. I don't think there's any suggestion that was admitted by counsel in the earlier argument that there just is no information that we know of that we could bring up that would change anything. So I think not only did the defendant in this case get a fair trial, it looks to me like the defendant got a perfect trial. We always talk about you don't have a right to a perfect trial. Well, this is pretty much perfection, because there's not another issue in this case but this one. And the judge looked at this, and based on what he had heard and thinking that there was a re-traumatization and nobody was really objecting to that, believed that that was sufficient reason not to put this girl through it, especially given the fact that there's no evidence whatsoever that it would have made any difference. I know I'm a little short here, but I'm willing to talk longer, but I...
Yeah, we never chastise counsel for sitting down if they feel they've said what they wanted to say.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Erlinson, this is a first. I've never heard the state stipulate that the defense tried a perfect trial, so we'll let you explain why you're here.
Thank you. First, I'd like to point out that our motion to interview this young child was not based upon a determination or an attempt to try and challenge her credibility. I specifically stated that the defense submits that it is only fair that if a state is allowed to obtain and present testimony based upon a forensic interview, that the defense should be afforded the same opportunity. At the time this motion was filed, Laura Hawkins had already conducted a forensic interview. I believe the trial court already had our motions in limine concerning what the proper scope is of testimony concerning child sex abuse.
Did you have the results of that other interview the state had done?
We did, Your Honor.
Okay.
We had it right away. And so we knew exactly, and we also had a report from Laura Hawkins concerning her interview. So the trial court knew at that time what the proper purpose of her testimony was. The state had already designated that she was going to testify on the about her forensic interview. We also knew what the permissible purposes of an expert were, that they could testify on the characteristics of a child that had been sexually abused and compare the victims or alleged victims' characteristics with those. So we knew at that time, and the trial court was aware of what our proper purpose was, and it stated in our motion to rebut the state's evidence that it derived or gained based upon a forensic interview conducted by the state.
What about the state's claim that your expert was not qualified? qualified to do a forensic interview, although he certainly had qualifications in other areas.
You know, it's difficult to understand exactly, based upon Laura Hawkins' testimony, what is a forensic interviewer? What she says is, well, forensic interviewer, I'm charged with determining or validating or invalidating what a child tells me based upon a single interview. I don't do therapy. The purpose of her testimony was to demonstrate not only what the facts were, they wouldn't have to have her testimony there, realistically, if all they want to do is play the interview. And she didn't say anything about it. But she got in there and said, no, based upon this interview here, I think that because she demonstrated she had a knowledge about unique sexual experiences, that that's consistent with somebody who'd been sexually abused. I believe that the way she came forward, her behavior and demeanor, exhibited to me that she demonstrated characteristics consistent with sexual abuse. She demonstrated, based upon her demeanor to me, as I observed, that she hadn't been coached, or she didn't indicate signs of being coached. So she got together and, after her interview, formulated all of her subjective opinions and applied those and gave that to the jury. So whether or not, my expert was certainly qualified to testify on the characteristics of sexual abuse and comparing those characteristics and behaviors that he would have observed in the child victim had he been allowed to interview her to those of somebody who had been the typical model or of somebody who had been sexually abused. So whether or not he admitted that he could perform a forensic interview, I don't think is relevant. I think the relevance is, what is the proper purpose? What is the permissible purpose of such testimony in these kind of sexual abuse cases? Not whether or not what the definition is of a forensic interviewer. The state has advised the court that he didn't believe that she testified on what the characteristics are of a sexually abused child, or compare those to the alleged victim in this case. The state's expert did, and spent a lot of time talking about the consistency, how she believed that this child's story during this one-hour interview or allegations were consistent. Her descriptions of the acts themselves, of the place where they occurred, of the physical setting. She believed, based upon her demeanor and characteristics and the whole totality of the circumstances, that she was consistent throughout, and that was a characteristic of someone who had been sexually abused. She also talked about, there are certain things that you look at during the course of a forensic interview when you make a subjective determination whether or not it's consistent with the characteristics of sex abuse. In this case, she talked about how long did the defendant have his finger inside you? Said 5 hours. Well, she said, that's not crazy. Didn't cause me any concern, because based upon all these subjective beliefs and the totality of her interview and what she had gained through her questioning, she didn't think it was a problem, because she felt that even though this child, which she testified, was well more mature emotionally, cognitively, and mentally than that of a normal 6-year-old at the time she was interviewed, she said, well, that didn't really matter. We don't really have to worry about that, about this claim that this 5-hour time period. She said, we didn't have to worry about, based upon her demeanor and everything, we don't have to worry about her claim that it happened, this alleged abuse happened every single time I was over there. She said, well, kids of this age, they don't have a concept of typically, 1, 3 times, 5 times, or 10 times.
Now, would you describe that as vouching for her credibility?
In this case, Your Honors, and I spent a lot of time looking at the law on this before the trial, this witness here came very close to crossing the line on many occasions, considering vouching. But she was very artful, and she had had training from prosecutors as part of her role on how to get hearsay statements in of the alleged child victims, testifying tips and things like that. So she didn't actually make
Did she ask how many times she's done this and how many times she's, you know, how many times she's done this for law enforcement and how many times she's testified in court, basically as a forensic interviewer who then passes along kind of expert opinions?
Correct.
Did she testify as to the number?
I believe it was somewhere in the neighborhood of between, I think she said twice a month, and she'd been doing it for a couple of years. So anywhere between, around 100, I believe, Your Honor. I'm not exact on that, but she has testified in her capacity at the Child Advocacy Center for the state for at least 2 years, I believe at least twice a month. So she did have considerable experience testifying. I think it's also important to look at it, the case of Gray versus State again. And there they said that the compelling need for an examination exists where the state's expert conducts a personal interview in reaching his conclusions. That's exactly what happened here. The personal interview was the sole basis for the state's expert in reaching its conclusions. I believe it's also important to recognize that, yes, these cases are tough. And the state pointed out to the court that I wasn't very tough on this child victim on the cross-examination. There's several reasons for that, of course. One of them purely is maybe strategy. One is, and probably the most important reason is, I'm not an adequately trained professional to be able to ask the right questions or elicit the type of information necessary to support an inference that a child does or does not exhibit characteristics consistent with that of sexual abuse. And the sole purpose for these interviews, as proffered by the state, is that, well, we want to bring them in a neutral environment and reduce the possibility that there is further trauma. We want to get them, make them feel comfortable. The courtroom isn't a comfortable place, especially for these child victims. So I don't believe it's fair to chastise perhaps lack of aggressiveness.
Would you agree with Mr. Gormley's opinion that the child was rock solid in her position, in her testimony?
The child was very compelling based upon just solely the testimony of the child. However, there were other explanations and there were other factors in this child's life that our expert didn't have an opportunity to visit with this child about, to see whether or not that had an impact upon how she presented at trial.
Was the child asked about the 5 hours of the defendant's touching?
No, Your Honor. The child was basically asked a few questions concerning the incident, a few questions about the child's relationship with the parents. This case came down to basically the version of the child that the child gave to the forensic interviewer and the state's experts, or the state's expert and the defense expert. The defendant did not testify in this matter.
Did the child testify as to the 5 hours of touching on the stand, or was that just in the interview with the forensic interviewer?
Just in the interview, Your Honor.
First question.
Nothing else.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Olson. Court will be in recess till 10 o'clock.